Teachers at nearly every level of education prioritize the value of class participation. Studies, in fact, exploring this topic show that on average, certain types of participation might actually result in learning increases by about as much as a letter grade and a half on assessments. So, how is it that we as teachers can actually not only promote class participation, but also effectively develop students' skills in that and also assess that? That will be the topic of our conversation today on Teaching Matters.
Welcome to Teaching Matters, a podcast exploring all things teaching and learning. Teaching Matters is produced by NPR affiliate WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. And here is your host, Dr. Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University.
Joining me today on Teaching Matters is Dr. Alana Gillis, an assistant professor of sociology at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York. Dr. Gillis conducts research exploring the effects of inequality in education and has been recognized by the American Sociological Association for Innovative Teaching. Alana, thank you so much for being on Teaching Matters today. It's nice to meet you.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation.
Absolutely. So we were talking before we started recording that the origin story of having you on here is I ran across a tweet that you gave. I guess it was sometime over the summer. I don't recall exactly the timing of it now. Mm-hmm. And we reached out to you to come on the program. And I got even more excited about having you come on after I had a chance to read some of your work. So I want to really focus in on class participation. I think that all of us that, I don't want to overspeak this, many of us who teach in higher education value that as a part of a syllabus, but my daughter teaches middle school, as I think your sister does as well. She values class participation. So this is really something that spans age groups. We all think it's important, but yet really, you know, your article that I read was one of the first ones where I'm like, wow, I actually have an insight now on how to do that. So before we get into the details of that, though, I kind of want the listeners to get to know a little bit more about you. So I wondered if you could sort of talk about, I don't know, your education background and sort of what led you to go into higher education. And I also think it's interesting to hear about why you decided to become a sociology professor.
Absolutely. So I, like many students, entered college having absolutely no idea what to study, but knowing that I wanted to be able to somehow make a difference in the world. And took my first sociology class, and I knew this is it. Sociology was discussing social problems, and I felt like it was giving me tools to analyze how to, you know, analyze what's wrong so that we can try to understand how to make things better. And so I had been interested in being a teacher my whole life, and turns out very few places teach sociology other than colleges. And so there I was, decided to get a graduate degree and become a sociology professor.
So as I'm in the field of communication. A lot of our listeners might be in the field of education. I know that when I think about classroom communication and classroom participation, I think about certain things. You sort of, in your research program, tend to approach a lot of the classroom interaction stuff from a perspective that includes inequality and equality. Why has that become a focal point for the things that sort of drives you as a scholar?
Yeah, I, in some ways, just happened to stumble into this. In my field of sociology, I'm in a subfield called sociology of education. And that subfield is really focused on trying to understand inequalities in the way the education system is structured. So trying to understand how different groups of students are either systematically getting advantages or disadvantages in ways that we structure the systems, in ways that teachers interact with students, in ways that are often invisible to people who are just participating, where we tend to think that the hardworking and naturally intelligent students succeed, and those who don't succeed either didn't work as hard or just weren't naturally as gifted. And sociologists look at it and say, well, maybe it's something about the structures or the interactions that's perpetuating some of these problems. And so I came into it with this background, and then I knew I was interested in teaching, and I was like, well, I want to apply this, you know, subfield disciplinary knowledge into my own classrooms and thinking about what are things that I'm potentially taking for granted about the ways I plan to structure my classes when I finally get to teach by myself. And, you know, what are ways where I might have inequality unintentionally baked into things, and how could I potentially try to disrupt that?
So one of the things that you write about, and I think, and it obviously comes from your sociological perspective on the classroom, are structures. And I think that is something that sets your field in a different light than communication or education or other related disciplines. When you hear that term structure, what are some examples that would come to mind that might resonate with listeners where they go, ah, that's a structure that could promote inequality that I would have never thought of?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the sort of things that I teach my students about in my sociology of education classes, we learn about things like tracking, how certain students end up at an early age getting into more advanced classes than other students. And then because they've been in those more advanced classes over time, they're more prepared for the next level of advanced classes and then the next level. And so, you know, from students just participating in the system, it just feels like some students end up in these AP classes. They're just naturally more prepared for them than others. But really, it's about the decisions that were made about who gets into those classes, how to structure curriculum, whether it should be differentiated instruction or not. I think another example would be, you know, how schools are zoned, the way that, you know, the sort of schools that students attend when they are in elementary and secondary education is largely based on where their parents can afford to live, or whether their parents can have the knowledge or resources to be able to figure out how to send them to a better school. And so it's not that students, it doesn't have anything to do with the student ability, but it's really the, you know, policies surrounding the educational access that they have. I think another important thing that will sort of motivate part of this study is we can think about one of the structures as being what education policy looks like. And, you know, ever since No Child Left Behind in the early 2000s, we have really focused on standardized testing in the elementary and secondary education world. And that has some unintended consequences where there's a lot of students who are well-trained how to take multiple choice tests and are not well-trained in how to communicate in open discussions in classrooms. Those aren't skills that were part of the standardized tests. And so those weren't the things that teachers were incentivized to teach. And of course, we have so many great teachers who are going beyond the standardized curriculum, but they can't go too far from it or else their own job or their own school's performance metrics could be penalized. And so those are structures that are impacting what teachers are doing. Mm-hmm. And so it's impacting what our university students are coming prepared to college to do.
Very good. Thank you for those detailed examples. Let's shift gears and talk about the article that you published in Teaching Sociology. The thing that struck me, excuse me, about your article is you really took class participation and you unpacked it by talking about it as a skill development rather than sort of a process product thing that, you know, I think, well, let's start with this. It's important. Why do you think it's important? And how is it that, based upon the research that you did, that people are typically in their syllabus saying, here's how I'm going to assess it? I mean, what strategies do people use? And then I'll come back to the process product question.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me when I was a graduate student preparing to teach my first course was realizing that almost no one specifies in their syllabus how they actually assess it. So almost never are students actually knowing what their professors are doing. So, you know, it depends on the type of university, but it's extremely common to have participation as part of a student's grade. And almost never is it specified how that grade is determined. And so it's this just complete black box for students where they don't know the behaviors that they're expected to do. Some professors will make it somewhat clear when they'll say things like, my TA is going to record how many times each person talks each class period, and that, you know, students can pick up the hint, okay, it sounds like I'm going to be graded by how many times I raise my hand and speak. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of professors, they tell students that it's this nebulous thing that involves participating in class. It involves, you know, potentially attendance. You know, some faculty include attendance as part of participation, some that's a separate category of the syllabus. You know, and some of them make it clear that, you know, following class norms or going to office hours, those could potentially factor into participation, but you don't know because most of your professors aren't telling you. And so that was one of my biggest frustrations, like the personal story of how this article came about was really the practical sense of as a TA, I was really frustrated about the ways I was expected to assess participation because I felt like students didn't know what they were supposed to be doing in order to get a good participation grade. And I didn't think that some of the metrics were fair. You know, there were some students who I could tell were engaging great in class discussions with their peers, but when it came to full class, all of a sudden they were silent and they're getting zeros. Mm-hmm. And I really felt, well, maybe there's something more going on here. Maybe there's ways to capture some of this additional ways that students are engaging in class. Or some students, you know, I was one of those students, I would leave my favorite classes and I'd go tell my twin sister about all the exciting things I learned about in class. That is such a valuable way to learn by teaching someone else. Mm-hmm. And in normal participation, that wouldn't ever be something the professor would ever know was happening. And so I was like, there's got to be something more holistic here from a personal standpoint. And then as I started unpacking it more of thinking through, what do I want to do here? I started realizing the ways that some of the answers about why are students doing what they're doing are because of inequality.
So I got to tell you, I felt guilt from my own actions after reading your article, because I was one of those people that participation was always like templatively mm-hmm. on my syllabus. And honestly, I never downgraded a student because I never had true data to draw upon. It was just really there as a thing, or at the best, it was because of attendance. Now, you mentioned this towards the end of your answer just then, but, you know, again, kind of going back to your sociological frame, there are certain inequalities. If you're using attendance, or if you're using mm-hmm. sort of a quasi-counting method for participation grades, and so you actually go to that step where you might have something written down in a spreadsheet, right? Mm-hmm. You pointed out really smartly in your article that could introduce certain inequalities for students that instructors may not think of. What are some of the reasons that you think that those inequalities could be present in a system like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me give you a few examples where we break it down by different, you know, sociologists are all about the groups. And so I'll give you some examples of some groups. So if we think about one category, one group of students would be students who are from poorer backgrounds. They were more likely to go to schools who, because they didn't have additional time or resources, were very much focused on the standardized testing metrics because their schools were at risk of being closed down or potentially were closed down if their standardized tests weren't high enough. Whereas students who were wealthier, who could afford to go to better resource schools, didn't have to worry about that as much. And so those students were more likely to arrive in college having not had experience participating in full class discussions because that wasn't the way that their education was previously taught because of the structures their teachers were under. Another group we can think about is students of color. So a number of students of color, you know, have had experiences of racism in the classroom where either their peers or their instructor have responded to comments they've made in ways that are, you know, perpetuate microaggressions or, you know, make it seem like, oh, wow, I, you know, that's such an intelligent answer. And it's like, well, why are you surprised I'm having an intelligent answer? You know, the student's getting the signal that people aren't expecting much of me. People are responding differently to me. And so maybe this isn't a space that I do feel comfortable speaking up in. And then I think getting back to the question you had about attendance as well, if for those of us who think of it as part of participation, which I do, we can think about students who have physical or mental health disabilities, that there are reasons why those students should sometimes be missing class. And if our attendance is purely based on the spreadsheet, did you show up today or did you not, then we're penalizing students because of their disability and not because of their interest or engagement in the course. And you know, those things are fundamentally not fair, and those were things that I didn't want to penalize students for.
So you point out in your answers that sort of a simple view of participation is that if I'm a professor that grades on that, that I might view that as being sort of a personality character, and I grade based upon that, but students start at different places, and it might be difficult for my grading to actually account for the fact that there's inequality at the start, and that I'm grading on a personality factor. You can see all sorts of reasons why that could become unfair for students. You actually deepen this discussion by saying that participation isn't just presence and isn't just personality, but it's actually a constellation of skills when you think more deeply about it. Can you kind of go into an explanation of how you break down participation into discrete skill categories like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things when I realized I wanted to do something different than I had seen, but what would that look like, was starting to think through what are some of the skills that are needed to succeed at participation, or what are some of the behaviors we want to reward, what some of the behaviors we want to incentivize. And, you know, some of that might mean, you know, the skill is getting comfortable doing something that you feel uncomfortable about. You know, that's a real skill. And giving students the tools to realize that they're capable of developing that skill, even if it feels uncomfortable or even if it feels totally out of their wheelhouse. And so the way that I thought about it, and one of the things that's really important is that I think that all professors should think about what are the skills necessary in their classes and how to take my template and really make it work for what you think are the important skills for your class. So that's an important caveat. So the way that I have divided it in most of my courses has been the first category is attendance and tardiness. So that's being in class, being on time, not leaving early. Again, you know, with an asterisk there about thinking about there are times where you should potentially miss class and not penalizing them for it. The second is preparing for class. So I think that students can't be expected to participate well in class if they didn't come prepared. They're not going to have anything to say in my discussion where I'm asking them, you know, what do you think of the author's argument if they don't know what the author's argument was? And so tasking them with coming to class prepared, having done the reading or watched the video or done the problem sets, you know, whatever it is in your discipline, and really coming prepared to actually engage with whatever that material is for the day. The third category is what I called participation in small group discussions. So that's specific to my class. I don't think that, you know, I think a lot of professors use that, but it's something that's fundamental to my class. And so it needed its own category, because in my class, what we do is we have a series of small group discussions to get them discussing things in a more low stakes way before they potentially are sharing in front of a whole class. There's a lot of students who are not ready for the skills to participate in the full class, and they can build them up in the small group first. And so in the small group, it's things like sharing your perspective, but it's also learning how to actively listen to your peers, stay on task, not get distracted, and not distract each other. And so then the fourth category is participation in full class discussions, which again, you know, hopefully we're pushing students towards speaking in full class discussions, but also again, actively listening to our peers, staying on task, not getting distracted. And then the final one I made as a catch-all, participation in other ways, where it can be the other things that are not necessarily seen in the classroom, but are really important to success. So things like going to office hours or talking about class material with your friends, peer editing, going to the, you know, campus writing center, all of those sorts of things that are absolutely going to enhance their ability to participate and engage with the course material, even if it's not in the classroom itself.
I appreciated all of what you just said. I loved, actually, though, the idea of actually making office or availability time with the professor, you know, relevant. Because I always felt awkward. I always wanted students to come visit me during my office hours. You know that it can be a lonely place during office hours unless you're really good at getting students to come. And I always felt like they were great discussions, and sometimes they were substantive, no question, especially when term papers or, you know, things like that were coming due. But I also felt like, what is it we were trying to accomplish other than just having a pleasant conversation, which is a great end in and of itself. What I really liked about what you wrote is that there's actually a learning opportunity for the student to practice something. Mm-hmm. And when I reflected on that, I think that is the benefit of it, is that a student is sitting one-on-one with a professor that they you know, look up to on some level, hopefully, and then learning how to interact with them. That's an important skill that carries over later in life.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I drew from my background in sociology of education, where the research shows that students who attended more elite schools have already been taught how to sit and talk with someone who feels very much your superior, and be able to have a conversation where you engage with them in a personal way, you build that repertoire of connections, We call this cultural capital, where you learn how to culturally interact with a person like that. And so the students from, you know, the students I have who went to boarding schools who then come here, they're comfortable coming to my office. I mean, for the most part, of course, there's personality differences in everyone, mm-hmm. but they've had experience sitting down with their, going to their teachers, you know, in a one-on-one setting and having a conversation with them that's not just, can you explain what this grade was? And that's a valuable skill that they'll need if we hope that all of our students can hopefully, you know, learn to interact with management and bosses that can help them succeed in their, you know, professional lives, and also thinking about the ways that they might interact with civic leaders to try to, you know, engage democratically as well. And so I think that, and another key piece of research that this draws on is that part of the way that middle class parents teach their kids how to engage in the education system is that they're taught to teach their, to use their teachers as resources, whereas students from working class backgrounds are taught to be of more of independent learners. And we need both. We need our students to be independent learners and to use teachers as resources. But so many students have not learned how to use a teacher as a resource that they think they're bothering us if they're coming, or they don't know what to talk to us about. And so having some of the students in my classes set the goal of coming to meet with me in my office, and they admit, they're like, I don't know what to talk to you about. And I will sometimes give them tips like, when you come to my office hours, here's possible things we could talk about. And they show up and they're allowed to say that they're really nervous and that this feels awkward. And then hopefully I put them at ease enough that they say, wow, this isn't as scary as I thought. And then they end up telling me they've gone to other professors' office hours. And I'm like, yes, that's exactly what I wanted.
Yeah. So if I'm in your class and, you know, I how does it work for me as a student if I'm in your class? Do I set goals and then report on progress? How do I decide which goal I want to emphasize? Sort of what are the mechanics of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the mechanics of it is that within the first week of class, I explain what this participation system is. We go over enough so that the students understand what my class is. So for instance, my class has no exams. So engaging in study groups is not the right sort of participation for my class, whereas it's a great one for other classes. And so students are then tasked with evaluating themselves in a baseline way on those five categories that I talked about before. And so it's really important for me and for students to understand where are they coming from, because the whole purpose of this participation system is growth. And so if someone's already really good at something, that's not something they need to grow on. We need them to choose other skills. And so helping students reflect on what they're good at, some students are already, you know, already have experience in that. And some of them are like, I'm not used to being asked about this. I'm just told by other people what I'm good at. And so it's a useful skill. So they evaluate their baseline in each of those categories. And then I tell them that they need to pick three goals that will be working on things that they genuinely want to improve, and that will, you know, are some way related to one of those categories, you know, so that students don't pick something that's completely unrelated, though that doesn't happen that often. And so the idea is that students are setting goals about things that they need to improve on. So either developing skills that don't exist right now, like have no ability to come to a professor's office hours, or things that they are okay at, but they're not great at, and they want to improve at that. So a student who says, you know, when there's participation grades in class, I do make myself speak up like once a month, but I recognize I want to try to do that more. Maybe my goal is to speak once a week in class. And that's a huge progress for them. Whereas another student speaking once a week in class, they're already doing that. They're already surpassing that. Maybe that student's goal actually is they need to count to 10 before they raise their hand, and they need to learn how to make space for other students. And so it's really about reflecting on what you already succeed at and what are ways that you can learn how to participate in new ways. And so the students set their three goals. I give feedback in case, you know, they sort of miss the purpose of the assignment. And then we have informal check-ins throughout the semester. We have a formal check-in at midterm, see how they're making with progress, remind them these goals exist in case they somehow forgot them, and an opportunity for me to give them feedback about, you know, yes, I see you're making progress here, or like you're really off base here. You really need to, you know, push ahead in the second half of the semester. And then at the end of the semester, they assess themselves of how they did in participation on all five categories throughout the course, and most importantly, reflect on how well they did at meeting those goals. And it's really about process, not just outcomes. So really explaining what they did to improve on those goals so that they start reflecting on the fact that they learned how to do something, or that they thought this was about personality, but turns out it is a skill I'm capable of doing, or the process of coming to my office hours once and realizing it wasn't that scary. And then that's what helped them realize they could go to another professor's office hours. And so helping them develop what a lot of us in education call like the growth mindset, that they are open and receptive to the idea that they are capable of developing the relevant skills. And so then I tasked them with proposing their own participation grade. So given all this data that you've collected about yourself throughout the semester, what do you think you've earned? And you know, I give them guidelines like, if you haven't met all your goals, you're probably not getting an A, but that you're supposed to, you know, always remind them, compare you to you, not to others. And so some students who never speak up in full class discussion, who get to the part of meeting, of participating once a week, that's amazing. And some of them, you know, sometimes have troubles giving themselves credit. They're like, yeah, but these other people participated so much more than me still. And I'm like, but look at how far you've come. And so I have students propose their own grades so that they have to deeply reflect on what do they think that they've earned, and then I potentially adjust it. Most often I'm rounding them up a little bit. I think they undersell their skills. Every once in a while I round down.
The thing, so many things I want to say in reaction to that. So the first is, I love the way that you're giving the students an opportunity to reflect on something that would have remained hidden but for your assignment. And what I mean by that is, I think for the most part, the routine things that we do in class, like having participation and discussions with our students, that's not something that most students 5 years later would ever think of saying during a job interview or, you know, whatever situation that they're in. Here's what I learned or what I did that was really relevant, you know, from a class that I took. And I think you're really using this this opportunity for students to have a deep reflection on how they did grow as a communicator. And of course, all of the skills that you're identifying as part of participation is essential when students go into any other organization, whether it's a job or a civic organization or whatever, all of those skills are going to be just as relevant. So I love that. I also, a while back at the beginning of our conversation, I brought up process product, and it feels like many of us were using sort of a very product oriented assignment. I'm going to count things that's easy to count. I'm going to count attendance and use that to assign this. And you really flip that with your approach to make it much more of a growth process oriented assessment. So I really appreciate that. When you mentioned the transfer effect from the perspective of students visiting you and then doing that with other professors, are there other aspects of participation where you also saw this transfer effect? And you may want to define that for the listeners. I read the article, they haven't, so you might unpack that term a little bit.
Absolutely. I have not used that yet in our conversation. Yeah, so I talk in the article about the transfer effect, because one of the things that, you know, I wondered when I first implemented the system was, am I just creating robots who are giving me the output that I want to see? Are they just doing the things that I want them to do because they're getting a grade for it? Or are they truly developing skills that will last beyond my classroom? Obviously, the second is what I was after. I'm wanting them to develop skills that they will take with them into other settings. You know, I'm not doing a longitudinal study, so I don't know how they're taking it to their job interviews. But I did, when I was writing the article and in the many semesters since then, a lot of students choose to tell me about the way that it's impacted them in other classes. And so students telling me that they are transferring the skill of meeting with me, meaning that they're learning how to meet with an adult, you know, the professor, and get feedback, has then been the thing that then helped them meet with another one. That students are telling me that they, by learning how to participate in the full class discussion in my class, they are developing the skills that they need so that they actually saw themselves participating more in other classes that same semester. Some of the students telling me that they know they've gotten in horrible habits with using their phone all the time or their laptop, you know, in distracting ways, and that some of them will choose to set that as a goal in my class, and that they found they were doing the same thing in their other classes and how much it was helping them learn. And so what I have seen has been that these are skills that we can teach students that they will take with them. So by emphasizing the process over the product, we are developing skills that will transfer to other settings, and so that they will carry with them. I think one of the coolest things, when I first wrote that article, it was actually after my first year teaching, when I was a graduate student instructor. I taught, you know, one course a semester. It's now been 6 or 7 years since then. And one of the cool things has been, I've now had the opportunity to have the same students in multiple courses, you know, over the years. And I have been able to see that they're coming into my class with different foundations than they had. They're not having to start back over from scratch because they have built skills they're bringing in. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really critical when we're thinking about what is the purpose of education? What are we trying to teach students? And I'm not trying to teach students how to succeed in Dr. Gillis's class. I'm trying to teach students valuable skills that I think that they need to be successful in all the ways of life that we'll have, you know, throughout college and beyond.
You've been using this approach for a while. Have you been able to even anecdotally observe that there are certain aspects of participation that has more of a growth for the majority of your students than others? Like, in other words, are you seeing patterns that, you know, become informative in some way?
I'm trying to think about that question. So I have definitely noticed, surprisingly as a sociologist, that the general structures that students are in are actually influencing some of this. And so I developed this system before COVID. I used it during COVID, and I've now continued teaching it in what some people call post-pandemic, though obviously the virus is still with us.
Yeah.
But we're fundamentally in different places than, you know, when I was teaching remote courses for a year or two in there. And so one of the things that has struck me is that students can reflect on how the structures around them are going to impact them as a student and try to create ways to adjust to that. But oftentimes they need the push to think about it. And so I think that one of the things that has really struck me is it actually is helping students learn how to be a better student. And so, you know, that the goal of keeping their phone away or their computer off, that was one of the most common ones when I was teaching more remote classes or semi-remote classes. And I'm not saying some students don't still need that now, but it's been less common now. And now we're back to some of the students being, you know, more tasked with things like, you know, the class discussion format or, you know, I think a number of things that I've also really enjoyed seeing more, and I think it's probably because I'm emphasizing it more, is more students learning how to take their own mental or physical health disabilities seriously. And so students who have mental health disabilities that cause them to miss class sometimes or be late to class sometimes, I think used to beat themselves up for it a lot. And I think they still do in a lot of ways, because they're taught that, you know, perfect attendance is the goal. And so if I'm not getting perfect attendance, there's something wrong with me. And I think one of the things that I've enjoyed seeing students in my class do is some of them will write goals related to, I will learn how to, when I am in a really bad spot, I will learn to be willing to let go of class for a few days until I've restabilized. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so critical, because students can't recover, whether it's physically or mentally, if they're being drowning in guilt for the fact that they're not going to class or falling behind. And so I think that's one of the things, I think I've emphasized it more. To disclose about myself, I've developed long COVID in the last 2 years. And so I talk about health a lot more than I used to and talk about ways that I have to try to give myself grace. And I think it's helping students feel that they're allowed to do that for themselves. And it's ultimately those are things that they're potentially going to carry with them in the future. Their, you know, depression or their, you know, really deep anxiety, and being able to learn how to manage those things and still be a good student and be a good worker, I think is essential.
That point is so good. And I reflect on I teach a first year student class in the college. I feel like the discussions where I'm able to actually, you know, talk with them about things like work-family balance, because I do talk about my family a lot. My wife is also a professor, and many of them know her. And so anyway, I talk about that a lot. And I've reflected on this point that I think as professors, we don't often model important life skills like that. And it's not that it's our job to necessarily, but we're a different type of adult than a student's caregivers or their teachers in high school. And I think it's important, especially because of the well-being issue, for students to start to understand that, you know, you have to figure out ways to feed your soul and your mind with yourself in addition to being with other people. And I think that's such an important lesson. And I think that, especially because of COVID, I think there's a lot more of us that are trying to grapple with how to do that and still maintain the appropriate professional boundaries that right. you have to have as a teacher. So I want to switch slightly gears. So you mentioned earlier that you have a twin sister. That's cool to hear. You actually got to publish with her, and you wrote about the fact that you took your model and she used it in one of her middle school Spanish classes. Can you just kind of talk about what you, the two of you, observed in that instance of using this approach?
Yeah, absolutely. So she was like, hey, I think I'm doing the same thing that you talked about other people doing. If I give my students participation grades and they don't necessarily know what those are or what that means. And so we spent one summer deciding how to transition my approach, which at that point had been out for a few years. I'd heard from hundreds of people across the country and the world who had implemented it in all sorts of disciplines. So it can go far beyond sociology. I knew that, you know, it was meant to be flexible. But how do we switch it to be developmentally appropriate, in this case, for middle schoolers? And so we started with the same baseline of thinking through what are the dimensions or skills that we think middle schoolers should be focusing on in participation. And so new categories got added. So things like being an independent learner, where, you know, where you rely less on asking the teacher every time you have a question and learning to use the class resources around you. Or she made a category about organizational skills. So, you know, bringing the homework back to class or keeping your locker organized, things that, you know, actually I think probably do plague some of my college students, but I don't explicitly have in my, and so we were thinking through what are the skills middle schoolers specifically are needing to learn at that age. Mm-hmm. And so once we developed, I think there were about 8 different categories. Then once we developed those, we said, okay, what's the next thing? Okay, developmentally, middle schoolers need more frequent check-ins than college students do. And so she, you know, developed the system where it's incorporated into every unit, where they set goals at the beginning of the unit, and then those goals can be specific to that unit. And so, you know, if that unit has a project versus a test, they can switch up their goals. So it really teaches them how to create goals that are specific to the tasks that they will be needing to do in that unit, so that they start being able to plan, so that in their other classes, when they have a test coming up, they've learned from Spanish class what are the steps you should do, like learning to study more than the night before. Again, another student, you know, something of our college students could work on too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we set it up with more frequent check-ins. And it took some wrinkles. Middle schoolers need a lot more help with reflecting on their own skills than college students do. And so she has to dedicate a lot of class time at the beginning of the course. And for the first, I think, 3 units, she does it as a completion grade, because she knows that middle schoolers are really struggling to reflect on their typical behaviors. They really struggle to set appropriate goals. And so for the first 3 units, it's completion grade. Did you do the reflections? Did you set goals that meet the class criteria? Did you write the reflections? And then starting to actually grade, did you meet the goals or not? To really set the students up to start developing that critical thinking, critical reflection of themselves that they at that age are just starting to be able to do. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it was a huge success. It went from just her Spanish class. It's now embedded in her whole school's 6th grade curriculum. It's their like middle school 101 foundation of helping prepare students. What is middle school like compared to elementary school? Mm-hmm. And really trying to set the foundation for the rest of their secondary education and beyond.
It had to be also cool for you and your sister to both have names on an article together, right?
Yeah, it was fantastic. So it's one of those things where, you know, I'm Professor Gillis and she's Senora Gillis. And, you know, I have at this point, you know, a number of publications, conference presentations. Mm-hmm. And so it was really cool to develop it together. She's the one who gave the conference talk. She gave a talk to other middle school teachers about how to implement it. And so it's been a really awesome experience. I will admit that the peer-reviewed article is on pause because my health has not been good enough to focus on it. But she is very excited for the day that peer-reviewed version comes out too.
Absolutely. Well, You've done a lot of other interesting research on inequality. I really also enjoyed reading your article about high flex modalities. I think we don't have enough time to delve into that today, but I would love, you know, at some point for you to come back on the show. I think the work you're doing overall is just really great to read and having an impact. And ultimately, as scholars, that's what we hope happens with our work. So congratulations on that.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's something that, you know, I don't know that I'll ever write an article with more impact than that one, because so many people across the world have implemented it in their classes, and they're reporting their students are having a better education because of it, and I couldn't ask for more.
Absolutely. And for listeners that are interested in learning more about, you know, what Alana's been talking about, we have a link to a blog that you can access freely. And then inside that blog post that she wrote, there are links to the actual scholarly article out of Teaching Sociology. The blog itself does a very good job of summarizing all of this, and so you'll be able to get a lot of information there. So I want to thank you for being on Teaching Matters. It's been great to get to know you, and I hope to have you back as a guest sometime.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. My guest today has been Dr. Alana Gillis. She's an assistant professor of sociology at St. Lawrence University. We want to thank her for being on. If you have ideas or ideas that you would like us to delve more into on Teaching Matters, you can email us at teachingmatterspodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at ohio.edu, or of course you can reach out to us on social media. I also want to thank the staff of the podcast. We have assistant producers April Koska and Trinity Sweet, who helped put this together. We thank all of you for listening. If you're listening on a traditional podcast platform like Spotify, remember we also have a YouTube version of the podcast now that you can check out on YouTube. All you have to do is look for Teaching Matters Podcast on those platforms and you will be able to find us. We hope everyone has a great day, and thanks for listening.